The following talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi during a Fusatsu ceremony at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
Common to virtually all the schools of Buddhism are the 10 wholesome and unwholesome actions. In our lineage, the Bodhisattva precepts. The primary practice of the Bodhisattva path is the paramitas. It's how the Bodhisattva cultivates the qualities of a Bodhisattva, refines themself, and gives of themself. In the Prajnaparamita Sutra, the Buddha said that the Bodhisattva, this great being, when they course in the six perfections, which means to practice, embody these six perfections, for this Bodhisattva, whatever gift they might give, they make this common to all beings, and then turns it over to the Supreme Enlightenment. They offer up the merit of that action, of that giving, to Supreme Enlightenment. And all of this without taking anything as a basis, without abiding anywhere, holding on to anything, solidifying anything. Whatever morality they guard, when they course in this, they cultivate the six perfections. With this mindful reflection, if I do not give gifts, then I'll be reborn in a state of woe, and there will be no maturing of beings that I can be a part of. In other words, that I won't be able to mature other beings, be of service. Nor will I purify the Buddha field, nor will I gain all knowledge, wisdom. It occurs to the Bodhisattva, if I don't guard my morality, then there will be a rebirth for me in the three states of woe. And I won't be reborn among people or in an advantageous state. And therefore, I won't be able to be of service to mature other beings. Nor will I purify the Buddha field or gain wisdom. It occurs to them that if I do not develop patience, then my faculties will go to pieces, and I will not course on the path of the Bodhisattva, and I cannot help to mature other beings. It occurs to them when I become lazy and do not develop the path of a Bodhisattva, do not exert that vigor, then how can I fulfill the Buddha Dharmas? How can I gain wisdom? It occurs to them that if I become entangled in my distracted thoughts and I cannot train in all of the qualities of concentration, I won't be able to mature other beings, help be of service, alleviate their suffering. How much less then can I gain the knowledge of wisdom? If I am weak in wisdom and skillful means, then I will not fulfill the perfection of giving. If rather I fulfill the perfection of giving or practice through meanness, the perfection of morality, if I try to practice the perfection of morality through immorality, or the perfection of patience through ill will, the perfection of vigor through sloth, the perfection of meditation through distraction, the perfection of wisdom through ignorance, then I will not fulfill these six perfections. I will not go forth to wisdom. I will not be able to be ultimately of service to all beings. So it makes it clear, as the teachings do in the Mahayana in 100,000 different ways, that to liberate the self is to liberate others. That our training is to help us develop, it is also to help us be of service. And so an essential part of that is understanding the nature of causation. A greatly cultivated person does not ignore causation. They are not dark to the workings of karma. They are not confused by actions and their consequences. They do not ignore the conditions of their actions, their intentions, the results, the impacts. A person of practice does not indulge in apathy, complacency, laziness, numbness, particularly in relationship to causation. To live a Dharma life. And it can seem like a very strenuous life. Because the currents of our habits are strong. And so it takes, for a while, a particular amount of diligence, vigilance even, conscientiousness, resilience, stamina, perseverance, sincerity. And there's much in the teachings that emphasizes our own practice, right? Our own individual personal effort, those qualities that we're cultivating, those attachments that we have, the struggles that we encounter, how we can practice those struggles, because of course that's essential. But the teachings also acknowledge that there are many ways to be born into this world. There are many ways to move through a lifetime. And those things matter too. The time in which we're born, the place, country, the neighborhood, the family, the government, the wealth or poverty, the parents we're born to. Is it a time of peace or war? Is it a time of compassion or meanness? Is it a time of freedom or oppression? These things also matter. And Buddhism speaks about this in terms of favorable and unfavorable conditions. It recognizes that it's not just a matter of individual effort and individual practice. And so it speaks of how there are unfavorable conditions that we can be born into. And we can think of this in the sort of one sense in terms of rebirth and different realms of existence, which is how it's presented. Being born into a hell realm, being born into the realm of a hungry ghost. Sort of think of that quite literally, but we can also think of it and as it is and always has been in terms of the realms that we create on a day-to-day basis, the sort of tendencies that we have to create certain kinds of worlds within ourselves and around us. And yet, even though they're considered unfavorable, and some of them are more sort of decisive in terms of their impact, most of them are unfavorable, but subject to change. And so to be born in a hell realm, which is characterized by a life, a world, a time, an inner state of endless conflict, of disruption, of fighting, of anger, of hatred, retribution, pain and suffering. And in this hell realm, it's not just that this comes and goes, but it's sort of the dominant flavor. It's sort of the overarching and underwriting sort of quality of that life. It's the landscape. It's what occupies that person's thoughts, their concerns, their needs. It's the dominant view. To be born as a hungry ghost, to be born in a lifetime or in one moment or in a period of our life, driven by insatiable desire, an unquenchable thirst. This is a place where we can never be satisfied, but there is endless pursuit nonetheless, searching, wanting, plotting, but never being able to satisfy that. It could also be a place where desires are easily, endlessly satisfied. The store is always open, shelves are always full. You always have enough to get something, there's always something you want to get. And the belief in an end to this, any ultimate satisfaction, any true happiness is faded for the Hunger Ghost. It's no longer about that, it's just about shopping, searching, seeking, wanting. Here there's only the day-to-day, moment-to-moment wanting, hunger, thirst. To be born as an animal. Let's I understand this as a metaphor. Let's leave the animals alone. Right. In Buddhism, to be born in the animal realm is a world, a life governed by rules, routines, impulses, instinct, in the sense of an instinctual drive is a drive that you don't really have much of a choice about. You know, the Canadian geese doesn't think, I'm not going south this year. I'm done with that. In this world, the demands of those rules and routines leave no room for examination or questioning. They just are to be followed. So each day is a movement through that world of routines, through that world in the sense of dogmas. It's a kind of dogmatic life. It's a kind of tyrannical life that's really just moving from one fear to another. One forestalling of exposure or failure. The rewards are few. Punishments, the threat of punishment is ever present. Remember, these are unfavorable conditions, not conducive. Because in each of these realms, the landscape, the life in that realm is so consuming. It's so demanding. It requires so much of our attention just to live there, to make it, that there's just not really much room for anything else. Any other consideration, any other possibility. To be born among the gods. So here, you're far removed from the noise and the pain and the hunger. It all seems good all the time. There's no adversity, no real problems, no growth, no need to grow. Everything's good. No need to reflect. What would you reflect on? You get everything you want. Everything has been gained. Everything is being provided. Nothing is lacking. So it's a world of sort of abundant richness that never goes beneath the surface. It's just a world of riches. Here, there's no empathy, there's no need for empathy, there's no concern, no need for concern. Everyone around you is in the same situation. You don't need anything, they don't need anything. You don't really need anyone. A rich and superficial life where one takes all they can get and doesn't really need to give anything back. And then there's being born among those with pervasive false views. In a world where everything runs like normal, according to a very particular and pervasive view. Here, everything is clear and true and certain. It's a life of convictions, unexamined, confidences that are actually laced with anxiety, strong opinions and beliefs. The important matters are already understood. What is not yet understood either doesn't need to be or will be. Patience is a weakness. Questioning is disloyalty. A world of walls and boundaries where there is a truth that is known. And those who do not know those truths are enemies. And so again, in each of these realms, as we can imagine, or maybe we've been visited some of these, and how inclusive it becomes, and exclusive at the same time. So these are all subject to change, right? They can change. Because there is no absolute absolute. There is no world that is absolutely defined by any of these qualities. There is no person that is defined by any of these qualities. So they're always subject, open to the possibility of change. Even in the darkest night, the slightest bit of light offers a surprising amount of illumination. To be born where no Buddha has appeared in the world, this is more problematic. Here, your mind stirs. You give rise to a sense of dukkha. You don't know that word, but you know something. You feel it. You're experiencing it. You're wondering about it. You're questioning it. There's a healthy dissatisfaction that is born. There's a seeking mind that begins to come into presence. There must be another path. There is a calling, but no one answers. There is a seeking, but there's no path. There's wanting guidance, but there's no teacher. And then there's also being born without a sufficient mental or physical capacity, we might even say psychological capacity, to hear, to learn, to actually be able to practice the Dharma. The Dharma practice is not about physical prowess or high intelligence, but it is very much a body-mind practice. And so it does require a certain degree of sufficiency, right, of ability within the body, within the mind, to hear the Dharma, to understand the teachings, to be able to reflect, to take a posture of meditation. Most of us has encountered these realms, people living in these realms, maybe close up, maybe far away. Maybe some of us have been such a person at different times. All of us have, you know, at least driven through these realms, gotten out, had a meal there, bought some clothing, tried them on, tasted a bit. When they're entrenched and ongoing, then the conditions for encountering Buddha Dharma become more and more slight. Right? That's what it's basically saying. It's like, I mean, if you could separate the person from the realm, which of course you can't, because karmically the person, in one way of understanding, the person has created this realm for themselves. Another way of understanding is sometimes people are born into or thrust into a realm not of their choosing, not because of their actions. But in them, the possibility of practicing becomes harder and harder. When those realms are occasional, then they can actually be strong in a sense, negative examples of how not to live. I remember when I was young, I started working when I was young, and then worked all the way through, all through the latter part of grade school and then through high school. And, you know, I was a kid, so I had kids' jobs. So if I was in a restaurant, I worked in a laundromat, I was always in the back room. You know, I was never in the front. I mean, who's going to put a kid in the front? So I was in the back, but with adults. And these were adults from all walks of life, all kinds of socioeconomic backgrounds and realities, living in different worlds, worlds different than mine. And it was an incredible education. I met people that I, you know, didn't come across in my neighborhood, didn't go to school with, got to know some of them, heard some of their stories. And it was really the first time where I began thinking about, what is this life like? Right? What is this like? It seems difficult. But then, of course, there are favorable conditions. Right? That's what you've been waiting for, right? To be born as a human being. Being born as a human being is considered most favorable because we live long enough to experience adversity and suffering, right? And to raise bodhicitta. But we don't live so long that we can put it off forever. And so we have this sufficient amount of time, if we're fortunate, right? If we live long enough, to have enough life experiences that we realize, okay, this is not going the way I wanted, hoped, thought. Can raise bodhicitta, can seek, but we have to, but everything is impermanent, so we have to like respond, answer the call. We need to be born in a place where the Dharma is actually present. It's alive. To have been born in a time when a Buddha was born and taught, and those teachings are still available. We need to have sufficient faculties in our body and mind, again, so that we can hear, sit, study, reflect. We need to have lived a sufficiently positive life, healthy life, a sufficiently decent life, decent in the sense of not creating so much trouble that our karma has been fortuitous enough, fortunate enough, positive enough, that we have found our way to the Dharma. But again, none of these are absolutes. And I met people who, by their own admission, had never committed one unselfish act in their life. I'm thinking of particularly of people I got to know when I was doing a lot of prison work. I remember one student telling me this, and I knew him, and he was quite a wonderful person, I thought. And he came and he confessed that. I said, come on. He said, no, I'm telling you. I've never done anything in my life that was not about me. It was not putting me first. I've heard from people who said that they were in a hell realm in which there was no escape. And then a shard of light passed through. And they began to think and wonder and question. But generally speaking, to have lived a good enough life that we are creating positive karma, not only to be able to find a way to the Dharma, but so that when we encounter the Dharma, the burdens that we all carry from our past karma and the lives we've lived are not so heavy, so intractable that we can't engage. A sufficient amount of faith and trust and confidence to be able to trust the teachings when we encounter them. Right? If we don't have a sufficient amount of trust in the teachings, we can't hear them. They're not teachings for us. To be able to trust our teacher, our teachers, from whom we hear the Dharma, Again, if we don't trust them, then why would we listen to them? Why would we take to heart what they say? We need to have enough faith, right? 1% to start. Enough so that when we encounter the Dharma, we don't just turn around and walk away. We stay. We linger. We listen. Maybe we stay a little bit longer. Maybe we take a step forward. So for the professional cynic or skeptic or doomsdayer, practice is going to be very, very tough. The doors seem to be closed. Right? And so again, some of these things we can't change. We can't. If we've been born in a time when there's no Buddha, there's not much we can do about that. Unless you are that person. We can encounter other things. Of course, we can encounter Buddha Dharma. So no unfavorable condition needs to be completely absent. And no favorable condition needs to be completely present. That's good news. Right? So it puts us pretty squarely in a good place. This is a good news talk, if you didn't get that right. Shantideva, in his book, in his teaching on the Bodhisattva, says, I join my hands and pray to Buddhas who reside in every quarter. Kindle now the Dharma's light for those who grow bewildered in the dark of suffering. So there's a asking, a beseeching, please, I know you're here, right? Kindle the Dharma light, right? What if the Buddha, after his enlightenment and the reflection, after some days over what he had experienced, and then his discernment, should I teach? People are too cherishing of their habits, their attachments, their views. It's just not going to go well. And then the gods or some powerful person or some wandering person, somebody came and appealed to him and said, no, there are people who will hear this. There are people who are waiting to hear this. And what if the Buddha said, I don't think so. And we never heard. And that was it. We're not here right now. And so Shantideva is calling to that Buddha. I beseech the enlightened ones who wish to pass beyond the bonds of suffering. Do not leave us in our ignorance, but stay among us for a numbered ages. Don't leave. Stay. I was thinking about how in the very early years when things were tough, finances particularly, and sometimes every once in a while Dada Roshi, if he felt like I think we were being too, I don't know, not doing enough to make this place work and generate some income and programs and so on, he would say quite seriously, I think maybe I should just go get a job driving a truck and earn some money. And we were like, please don't do that. To live in a time when a Buddha has appeared. To live in a time when a Buddha has taught. To live in a time when the teachings are still present and can be heard. To be able to encounter the practice and do the practice. To find a teacher, a sangha. We can take these things completely for granted. And the teachings are very clear, we should not, but rather actually appreciate how fortunate we are. Right? Particularly in our culture, where we've sort of had this ingrained presumption, these expectations of everything that we are deserving of, that we should have, and think everything we should not have. We shouldn't have a suffering, we shouldn't have adversity. Right. Things should be easy. I should be able to get what I want. It shouldn't cost too much. That's a pretty modern delusion. And the teachings are very clear about this. Both it helping us to not fall into that kind of complacency, but also to appreciate our good fortune, how fortunate we are. You know, we can spend, particularly during Sesshin, we can spend a lot of time focusing on what is lacking. Not enough mindfulness, not enough concentration, not enough energy, not enough whatever. And if we can just pause for a moment and realize, okay, that's just practice. That's not new. There's nothing unique about that. It feels unique to us. It can feel especially special, right? Our distraction, our entanglements, right? Our struggles. And that's not to diminish or belittle the effect that they have on us. They hurt. But to step back a little bit and say, yes, and is there anyone who has not transgressed? Is there anyone who has not struggled? Is there anyone who's meditated and has not experienced this? The liturgy, the teachings, every service we do, every meal we take is pointing not just to the teachings and to the practice of that particular moment, but our good fortune. The liturgy is constantly pointing to our good fortune. The fact that we can just simply do a service, that we can chant a sutra. Oh yeah, the Heart Sutra. Yeah, have you read it? Yeah, I've read it. What else have you read? That's why the teaching or the comment that some people, when they read the Heart Sutra, they have a heart attack. Why would they have a heart attack? Because they take it seriously. And they realize, oh my God, is this possible? You have the good fortune to be sitting on this cushion, as do I, in the posture of a Buddha, to meet your mind. I remember years ago we did a retreat on ethics in business, medicine, or science, and one other thing I don't remember. And for business, we had a silent partner from Ben & Jerry's before it got bought out, when they were really about doing social service, social action. And he was talking about some of the plans they'd had. They were going to have an adopt-a-subway thing, you know, like adopt-a-highway, but in New York City, adopt-a-subway. But the unions just shut that right down. But one of the thoughts they had was, like at these G8, G20, you know, meetings with all the world leaders who are going to get together and decide things about us, that before they could start their meetings, they all had to have an ice cream cone. And it had to be in a cone, not a cup. Because when you need an ice cream cone, what happens? It starts to melt, drips over your fingers. He said, you become a child. You become a child. You remember what it's like to be a child. Everybody's sitting around table, licking their fingers. Okay, now let's talk about what's going on. Even better, after they've had their ice cream, to meet their mind. Their mind. Their biased mind. Their unexamined mind. To meet the minds of others, to begin to examine karma, to take responsibility for past actions and the actions that are happening right now. In this Zendo, at that table. And to realize we can set those free. We can open our hearts beyond what we can even imagine towards those that we cannot even imagine opening our hearts to. And that we can be a benefit in the world. That's what the Buddha was saying in the sutra. When we practice, we make ourselves serviceable. Our minds, our bodies, our emotions, our actions. This is how we express our gratitude. That's why it's so important that we have received these practices that have come down to us, that in every generation, right, in some generation, everybody got together and said, you know, Fusatsu, we don't really need that anymore. That didn't happen. Zazen, you know, it's just hard. People don't really like it. We'd get many more people if we didn't do Zazen. And that we can do these practices and be changed by them. And what makes that possible, to the greatest degree, is when you do them with your whole body and mind. All throughout. That's why it's so important to not become dull or dead to these practices that we do again and again. To continue alive in your mind, to continue to start again, to continue. And none of us do that every time. None of us do. Right? We are creatures of habit. And so these practices become habits. Don't let that run away. When I'm officiating a service and I realize that I have gotten lost, I feel bad. I do. For that moment, I don't, you know, don't put a hair shirt on, but I feel bad. Not only did I miss something, but I missed something. So, I'm not suggesting you feel bad, but that we take it seriously. Sean talked yesterday about sincerity. That's what makes this work.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as cushions, incense, liturgical instruments, Dharma books, and more, visit monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.